The next two cases on the docket are related to one another. However, they are briefed and argued separately. The clerk will call the first case, Anheuser-Busch, as the appellant. You may proceed.
Your Honor, may I please report? My name is Bob O'Donnell from the law firm of Van Diever Black. I am speaking on behalf of all of the premises defendants in connection with this appeal. With me this morning is Alexandra Cunningham of the law firm of Hunt & Williams, and she'll be speaking on behalf of the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company, now known as Huntington.
All right, well, let's stop the clock. So what you're doing is that you're this is 20 minutes for both sides for a total of 40. What you're doing is you're trying it as an appellant, and you're speaking for both Anheuser-Busch and Newport News Shipbuilding. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I'm speaking on behalf of the premises defendant, and Ms. Cunningham is speaking on behalf of the shipyard.
Right, and you're combining both of the cases now.
Correct.
With a rebuttal time that is reserved in one hearing, not in two.
Correct.
All right.
If
I understand. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Focusing on the issue before the court, the question is whether the trial court erred in granting a motion to non-suit after demurrer, which we contend were dispositive, had been filed by both the premises defendants and the shipyard, and they had been fully briefed and argued, and no further action was contemplated prior to the court ruling. This court has addressed the interpretation of Section 8.01-380 on several occasions in the past, and in this particular case, we're focusing on the third prong of that statute, which provides that a party may not suffer a non-suit unless the party does so prior to the time that the action has been submitted to the court.
Following Counsel, may I ask you this? Were the demurs that were pending, did they seek dismissal with prejudice, or did they seek dismissal without prejudice?
Justice Kelsey, the demurs of the individual defendants sought some of them sought dismissal with prejudice, some of them did not. At the argument that was held on December the 3rd, it's clear from the position taken by counsel for the premises defendants at that time that the contention was the demurrage was positive, and if granted, the case should be dismissed as to all the premises defendants. Now, following the analysis exercised by this court in prior decisions, the court need only address two questions. Number one, were the demurs dispositive if granted? And number two, was any additional action contemplated by the court prior to the court ruling? Focusing on the demur filed by the premises defendants, it is our position that no legal duty is imposed upon the premises defendants in a situation in which an employee of an independent contractor, in this case, is exposed to asbestos as a result of the work done by that independent contractor, unless there is an allegation that the premises defendants controlled the means and manner of performing the work. There is no such allegation in the initial complaint filed in this case. There was no such allegation in the amended complaint filed in this case. Indeed, there was no such allegation in the complaint filed in the Circuit Court of Newport News the day after the court announced its intention to rule on this case. And finally, there was no such allegation filed in the Circuit Court of Newport News when the case was amended to assert a wrongful death claim.
So if the trial court had agreed with that demurrer, the case is over vis-a-vis those defendants?
Yes. If the demurrer had been sustained, filed by the premises defendants, then the premises defendants would have been out of the case. That's our position. And regarding the second issue, it's also eminently clear that there was no further action contemplated by the trial court after the hearing on December 3rd in which the demurs were argued. Indeed, the court asked on three separate occasions whether anyone had anything further, and no one stepped forward. 6 weeks passed. The court's clerk announced that the decision would be forthcoming. And the very next day, the plaintiff filed a substantially similar case in the Circuit Court of Newport News. The day after that, the non-suit was filed in the Circuit Court of Norfolk. Now, it appears, from brief at least, that The position taken by the plaintiff in this case is that there should be a special exception to the statute in the cases of demurs, because empirically it appears that on a substantial number of occasions, demurs are granted with leave to amend. And because that's the plaintiff's position, he also submits that there was further action contemplated. There are two flaws with that argument. First, with regard to the demurs and being dispositive, this court ruled in Wells versus Lorcom Condominium Council and put demurs in the same category as motions for summary judgment, pleas and bar, and motions to dismiss, any one of which, and the key factor is any one of which, those pleadings, if it is dispositive when ruled upon in favor of the party who asserts that position, then the case is over. And the second flaw in the plaintiff's argument is that it focuses on additional actions contemplated after the court rules on the demur. And this court's instruction is the focus on additional action contemplated is to be action contemplated before the ruling is to take place. So because we submit that the premises defendant's demur, if granted, was case dispositive and clearly no further action was taken, this court should set aside the non-suit, remand the case to the trial court with instructions to rule on the case as it existed at the time the non-suit was granted.
Counsel, is the issue of whether or not the premises defendants, appellants that are here, the demur was in fact dispositive before this court?
Yes, it is. The court has to find, does not have to rule on the substance of the demur. It just has to find that if the trial court granted that demur or sustained that demur, then the case was dispositive. I believe that's the issue that Justice Kelsey was referring to. And again, because of the posture of the case that we submit was before the court, and that is that there was no legal duty, if the court had agreed with that position, then the case was dispositive. If there are no other questions, I'll turn the podium over to Mr. Cunningham.
Good morning. May it please the court. As Mr. O'Donnell said, my name is Alexandra Cunningham with the law firm of Hunton & Williams, and with my partner, John Epps, we represent Huntington Ingalls Incorporated, the shipyard defendant in this appeal. The shipyard is in the same posture as the premises defendants in this appeal. The same operative facts and timeline that Mr. O'Donnell just set out apply exactly the same to the shipyard. The shipyard also had a demur pending, and to Justice Kelsey's question, the demur itself requested dismissal with prejudice. Our briefing in support of that demur requested dismissal with prejudice. And at the argument, it's clear that counsel requested dismissal of the case with prejudice. And that's because the shipyard asserted in its demur that the legal cause of action that plaintiffs asserted simply does not exist under Virginia law. Mr. Cantrell never worked for the shipyard. He was never employed by the shipyard. He was never on the shipyard's premises. The allegations with respect to the shipyard involve conduct that took place for the most part before Mr. Cantrell was born or even conceived. As a result, the shipyard's demur was to a legal issue that could not be cured by any amendment of the pleadings. And rather than repeat on the substance of this court's precedent in Virginia Code Section 801.380, I wanted to address just the opposition from Cantrell and that argument that because there is often leave to amend granted in a demur situation, that is somehow the further action contemplated that would make a non-suit available. First and foremost, that is just not the law. And to accept that interpretation would require this court to rewrite the Non-Suit Act and reverse almost 60 years of precedent interpreting this last limitation. Second of all, there is no per se rule, as this court is aware, that a demur must be granted with leave to amend. This court has made clear in multiple cases that leave to amend is inappropriate in a situation where there is no way to cure the defect and where it will just lead to re-argument of the same issue. And we've cited those cases in our brief, including the Ward's Equipment case and the Heckler Chevrolet case. And then finally, the third point is that Cantrell had already amended at the point that we were at the hearing on December 3rd, 2013. That was the first amended complaint. He had filed an original complaint to which the defendants, the shipyard defendants and the premises defendants, had filed similar demurs to the legal issues. And so we were already there. At that point, that presumption as far as liberally being able to amend no longer applies. At some point, that part doesn't matter anymore. In any event, we would contend that what happens after is not a part of this court's analysis. It's not something that this court has to address here. The issue is whether the motion that was before the court at the time was dispositive if granted as requested. And it is undisputed that the demurs did seek that relief. They were dispositive if they were granted as requested. And at that point, the trial court had no discretion to grant the non-suit at that time without deciding the demurs. With the court's permission,
we reverse this case and send it back. We have two almost identical cases pending in two different jurisdictions, right?
Your Honor, that would be correct, although I would note a couple of things on that issue. First, legally...
By the way, I asked the question more out of curiosity than anything else, because I don't think that's relevant to this question.
Right, and that's where I was going, that I don't think that's relevant to the legal question before the court right now. What happens after has never been a part of this court's analysis in this type of case. Second,
so you'll simply deal with it with the both courts if we reverse this one, and we'll see it again, right?
Well, I think that may happen at some point, Your Honor. But in any event, I would point out just also that the result, the two cases are really, it's a self-inflicted result. It was the procedural mechanism by which the Cantrell chose to get out of the Norfolk court. Second, I think that in reality that result is never going to happen because, as Your Honor points out, we either go back to Norfolk on remand and we're successful, in which case you see the case up here on the merits next year, or we're not successful. And then his right to reopen, then his right to non-suit comes back at that point in time, and he has the choice again to non-suit the Norfolk case and go back to Newport News. I would reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal.
8 minutes and 30 seconds.
It pleases the court. Excuse me, I'm Charles Siegel from the firm of Waters and Krause in Dallas. I thank the court for admitting me pro hac vice into this case. My partner, Peter Krause, is actually a licensed Virginia attorney and practiced in Virginia for 6 years before moving to Texas. He argued this case in the trial court. I think there's a simple question here, and that is, is the court bound by the literal holding of the Wells decision? Wells, you had three different motions pending, one of which was a demur. The court used language saying that any of those motions that were before the court would have been dispositive. We simply contend that Wells can't be squarely on point here because it's not a case in which...
If I may interrupt, if these demurs had been granted as they were requested, for those defendants, wouldn't the case have been over?
It would have at that moment, but we rest our argument on the common experience of courts, and this is exactly what the trial court said. I mean, the trial court didn't just give us a non-suit. The trial court held a hearing on their objections to the non-suit, and the trial court said what we maintain here, which is that in the common situation, in the normal situation, a demurrer is usually followed by leave to amend. It's true, as counsel stated, that we had amended once, but this was the first contested.
If we took that point of view, wouldn't the tail wag the dog? The seven of us would have to examine the demurs, make prima facie judgments on the legal merit of the demurs, essentially make a merits decide the demurs in order to determine whether a non-suit was available or not.
I don't I'm not sure I'm following the question, Your Honor, but I don't
think... We can't take judicial notice that sometimes demurs are granted with leave to amend.
I don't think the court would be setting up a rule which would require it in every case to enter the thicket of the substance of the demurs. These are pretty clearly demurs that would naturally give rise to leave to amend. This is not a situation in which there's some facial problem with the case appearing on the face of the pleadings, a charitable immunity issue or some kind of obvious immunity issue. This is the defendant saying there's no precedent in Virginia for a take-home asbestos exposure. And the court might say, well, you haven't properly alleged the elements of foreseeability, or you haven't properly alleged the elements of duty in a premises case.
Well, counsel, let me put Judge Kelsey's question a little bit differently, because I had asked opposing counsel this question. What you're saying now, it seems to me, is that you are putting the question before us as to whether or not we have to look into the merits of the demur in terms of whether or not, if granted, it would be dispositive. You just said these are the kinds of demurs that usually are given leave to amend. While you don't raise that issue in your brief in opposition, are you suggesting here that yes, in fact, that's what we would have to do in order to sustain your position?
No, I think it is correct that we take a narrower or, in a sense, broader argument in the brief, which is, and that's certainly still our threshold position here, that since demurs can and often are followed by leave to amend, that ought not to be the type of plea that would bar a non-suit in the situation in which we were in. That is a cleaner rule, and that would certainly obviate any need for this court to enter into a evaluation of individual demurs.
Well, if we had that situation, what about a demur that, in fact, there was no dispute in the facts about when the case was filed? A plea and bar or a demur is a demur saying that it's, well, I'm sorry, that would be a plea and bar, but what about a demur that, in fact, it was clear on its face that if granted, it would end the case? Wouldn't that be entitled to a prohibition of a non-suit under these circumstances?
I think the cleaner, more straightforward rule would not bar a non-suit even in that situation, but certainly trial judges would be in a position, I think, to make it very clear. I mean, that was not made clear in this case, but trial judges would be administering such a rule, would be in a position to make it very clear to plaintiff's counsel, speak up or forever hold your peace. I mean, Judge Jones didn't see it that way in the trial court and did
Even
not.
Though that may be a clear and straightforward approach, wouldn't we have to amend the statute to add that clarity?
I don't think the legislature would need to amend the statute.
Would we have to amend the statute to exempt demurs from the otherwise omnibus statutory prohibition under certain circumstances?
I think because the phrase submitted to the court for this, I think that phrase can simply be read by this court to not include situations in which amendments are available. And of course, the court wouldn't be adopting that rule in a situation in which amendments are rare, or this would be for the unusual situation. This would be for the normal situation. I think even defense counsel's brief acknowledges that Rule 1.8, I think it is, says leave to amend shall be liberally granted, and that is what normally happens. And again, I think it's, you know, the best statement of our position, I think, is what Judge Jones said at the hearing on the non-suit. Even if the court were to decide that, you concede that the court could decide there's no cause of action but still allow the plaintiff to an opportunity to amend to try to plead it. So this judge, who had been working on this decision for 6 weeks and who had heard a long argument, had no was not offended, I guess is the best way, by the non-suit, and certainly had no problem in concluding that it had not been submitted to the court for decision within the meaning of 8.01.380. So I for that I think is the best way to decide this decision is to simply construe that phrase, that third prong of 801-380, in the way the trial court did.
Why is that a better way than to just allow the statute to say what it says, to interpret it as you having submitted the case to the court? The court gets to decide either to sustain their demur, they're out of the case, overrule their demur and give you leave to amend, you take your non-suit. What's messy about that?
I don't, that's not messy either, Your Honor, but I think...
So why would we not look at the rule as written, the statute as written, and just read it as submitted to the court? It has been submitted.
I think that's an equally straightforward approach, if you will. It's no less clean than the rule or the construction we're advocating for. But our construction is equally easy to administer, I think. And in a way, it does more comport with the term, with the phrase submitted to the court for decision, because it implicit in demurrer hearings is usually the right to amend. And we have to remember that the right to amend was talked about not only at the non-suit hearing, where the court said, you know, look, this is where we would have been. I probably would have given you leave to amend. What also happened was that at the hearing on the demurrers itself, there was a discussion about amendment being granted, a leave to amend being granted. Now, it came up in a colloquy between the court and counsel for other defendants, the products liability defendants, not these defendants. But I think that was the assumption that the court was operating on. And if leave was going to be granted to amend the complaint as to products defendants, it's very reasonable to assume that the court was thinking along the same lines, or would have been thinking along the same lines, for these defendants.
Client, counsel, implicit in your argument on behalf of your client is is that Wells was wrong, at least with regard to one-third of them. Motions to dismiss are dispositive, please and bar are dispositive, but demurrers aren't really dispositive.
I think it's possible to treat Wells not as wrongly decided, but simply as language that was overbroad. I don't think it's necessary to declare it.
I guess the challenge is that the General Assembly hasn't treated it as language that was overbroad. That was 26 years ago. We were interpreting a statute, and the statute hasn't been amended since then to tell us we were wrong.
That's true. I don't think this kind of issue bubbles up very much to the legislature's attention. I don't think you can take the legislature...
Non-suit bubble up to the legislature fairly often, but that's neither here. That's not part of the record in this case.
I, there is certainly the doctrine that Your Honor refers to, that legislative inaction is one way of deciding that this court has properly construed a statute. But I think that I'm not knowledgeable as to how often the legislature deals with these issues. So I would like to address, excuse me, the statement by a counsel for Newport News Shipyard that the pendency of two suits upon remand is a problem of our own creation. It is a problem of our own creation, but after all, it's what the trial court allowed us to do, and I don't think that any inference, if you will, that the court ought to ignore the practical problems that are going to be created on remand simply because it was the plaintiffs who decided to file the second lawsuit. It wasn't the plaintiffs who decided to file the second lawsuit, but only after the trial court gave us permission to do that. At the time, there was only going to be the one lawsuit, and that was the lawsuit in Newport News. There will be practical problems.
What do you mean by permission? How did the trial court give you permission to file the parallel suit?
Well, the trial court gave us permission to non-suit the Norfolk. And the trial court was well aware when it did that...
But wait a minute. You filed the other suit the day you filed the non-suit before the court ruled on your non-suit.
That's correct.
So what permission are you talking about?
No, it wasn't permission in that sense. But the trial court allowed us...
Permission in any sense?
The trial court allowed us to non-suit the Norfolk case when it was well aware of the pendency of the Newport News case.
Is the Newport News case parallel with the exact same case?
Largely, except in the interim, Mr. Cantrell died, and so it's now a wrongful death case. But otherwise, the defendants are the same and the allegations are the same.
So if you non-suit in Norfolk, don't you have to refile in Norfolk?
There is an exception to that rule, Your Honor, that was discussed at the non-suit hearing, and I'm sorry I'm not familiar with what the argument was on that issue, but that is not a contention. I don't think...
I was just curious.
Yeah.
It's not a part of the case. I was just curious.
So on remand...
Counsel, while we're on this subject, was this the plaintiff's first non-suit?
As far as I know, Your Honor.
So this was a matter of right, not... The question really was the timing of it rather than...
Correct.
Whether
I don't think there's been any contention that we had no right to file it, other than the temporal issue.
Yes, thank you.
There will be practical problems on remand. There will be two lawsuits. There will be against different groups of defendants, but in every one of these cases, there are cross claims, there are third party claims, and there are all defendants plead in their answers that each of the other defendants in the case is responsible for the mesothelioma that was contracted by Mr. Cantrell. Here, if the case goes to trial, you will have, for example, the premises defendants blaming the products defendants, the products defendants blaming the premises defendants, everybody blaming the shipyard. But usually that all happens in one trial. Here,
could not the plaintiff have joined all those defendants in a single proceeding?
We did. We did that in Norfolk, and then we did it again in Newport News.
So what's wrong with the argument that you created that duality, and it's hard to hoist yourself up on that now?
Well, in the sense that I'm not trying to hoist myself up on it, Your Honor, but we created, but in our actions in the trial court, there was only ever going to be one suit, either in Newport News or in Norfolk. We started out in Norfolk, then there was going to be one suit in Newport News. It's the defendants who are contending for a situation which will result in two trial tracks, I'm saying. And again, we didn't get permission from the trial court to create this state of affairs, but the trial court, in a sense, was aware that this state of affairs was going to result or could result. I just want to review, I want to advert briefly to the contention that these were dead solid demurrers. We simply contended that the plaintiff had no cause of action at all, and that's all that, you know, that's all that could have been decided. What the plaintiffs were alleging was utterly foreign to Virginia law, and the trial court would have seen that, and there would be no way that the plaintiff could ever plausibly amend their complaint. With respect to the shipyard in particular, but also with respect to the premises defendants, this is a very, very late in time exposure. This exposure occurred in the household in the 70s and 80s, I believe were the dates, and in the for his parents working at the shipyard and taking the asbestos home on their clothes. And then Mr. Cantrell's own work for contractors on the premises of the various defendants. The cases around the country as to whether there is a duty in this kind of situation, in the take-home asbestos exposure situation, for example, are a mixed bag of holdings. Some go for the plaintiffs, some go for the defendants. But it's important to recognize that for the defendants, but for the cases around the country, and this hasn't really been briefed by either of the parties, but I think it's worth understanding as a background matter. Even the cases that hold for the defendants involve much earlier exposures. This would be one of the latest exposures in time of any case around the United States. And my point in saying this is that we fully hope to win on the demurrers, but if we don't, we expect to be able to amend. We would hopefully seek leave to amend. And one other thing is, when we get back into the trial, if this court reverses the trial court and we're back arguing this again in Norfolk, we are going to be citing the new case decided by this court just a few months ago, the RJR versus Settle case, which which takes a view of the law of foreseeability and negligence exactly as we espoused in the trial court argument on the demurrer.
Counsel, you say this is for background and we should know it, but I just want to understand that this presentation of background does not contradict your earlier answer, which was the subject, the nature of the demurrer, and whether or not you would be it would be sustained is not the issue before us.
That our suggested result and rule does not depend on the nature of the demurrer. That's correct. To close, if this case is re-argued in Norfolk or if it's argued in Newport News, we will be citing this new case, the RJR versus Settle case, which takes, if you will, an expansive view of negligence and foreseeability. At least that's how it's been characterized.
Counsel, isn't this argument for another day?
Fair enough. If the court has no further questions, so. Thank you very much.
Rebuttal.
May it please the court, a couple observations, and I'll leave room for Ms. Cunningham to follow up with what I've not covered. Responding, Chief Justice Lemon, to your question about dependency of two cases, again, while it's not part of this record, the court should be aware that last week the Circuit Court of Newport News entered an order granting a motion to stay, which had been filed on behalf of the defendants. So the Newport News case is stayed until all matters pertaining to the case in Norfolk are fully resolved. So the opportunity for there to be two cases has been resolved by that order granting the motion to stay. Speaking also on this notion of leave to amend, I believe we have cited on a number of occasions to the fact that demurrers can, in fact, be dispositive and often are. And that's all this court needs to know, I submit, to resolve the inquiry that we're engaged in here. A demurrer, just like a plea and bar or a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss, under the right set of facts and with the right law applying, as we submit in this case, can be dispositive. Therefore,
really, that it's interesting. It's fascinating arguments, but even that's irrelevant, isn't it?
Yes.
And the question is whether or not he granted a non-suit properly or not.
Yes, absolutely. But the inquiry, Your Honor, I believe is, or Chief Justice, is if the demurrer was sustained and if there was no further action contemplated, is the non-suit permitted? And the answer is clearly no, it's not. And that's what happened in this case. And while there's been a lot of discussion about leave to amend, it's worth pointing out that we now have four different complaints filed out of the same set of facts, two in Newport News and two in Norfolk, and four different opportunities to amend the critical allegations against the premises defendants, and the plaintiffs never exercised the opportunity to say that the premises defendants control the means or manner of performing the work, and therefore there is, in fact, a duty to the employee of an independent contractor.
If we grant the relief that you requested, it's up to Judge Jones to decide whether the demurrer is granted with or without leave.
Absolutely. No question. Your Honor, if there's no further questions, I'll leave the balance of the time to Ms. Cunningham.
Thank you, and I just have a few points, and they all start from that proposition that nothing that happens after matters. The question before us today is simply whether the demurrer was an action submitted to the court for decision at the time the non-suit was granted. Everything else that was talked about with respect to the merits, it is all of the defendant's positions, the premises and shipyard, that is not a part of this court's analysis. And to accept Cantrell's interpretation, you do, in fact, have to rewrite the Non-Suit Act. You have to change the Non-Suit Act. You have to rewrite the 10 decisions that have decided that third limitation and have made clear that as long as the relief requested is dispositive, then that's the end of the inquiry. And so the final points that I have addressed things he said, but I don't take the position that any of them are relevant to the actual indetermination. I do feel like it's necessary to correct The discussion regarding the allegations with respect to the shipyard, those are not the allegations that are contained within the amended complaint that is part of this court's record. Those are not the dates that are at issue in the complaint that is part of this court's record, and I can refer the court to the joint appendix at 352 for the actual dates alleged, which cut off much, much earlier than counsel suggested. And I think with that, Your Honor, no further from me. Thank you.
Thank you all for your arguments. I think no matter what we rule, we'll be seeing you again. The court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.